Welcome to NSL Unscripted, your inside look at the evolving landscape of national security law, brought to you by the National Security Law Department at the U.S. Army's Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. In each episode, we explore timely issues and trending topics with leading experts, practitioners, and academics in the field. Join us for a deeper dive into the critical topics that define national security law today. Welcome to another episode of NSL Unscripted. I am your host, Major Emily Bobbenreath, Associate Professor in the National Security Law Department at the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Today, I'm so excited to bring Professor Asaf Lubin, Associate Professor of Law at Indiana University Maurer School of Law, and a faculty affiliate at both Harvard University's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society and Yale Law School's Information Society Project. Professor Lubin holds a Bachelor of Law from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, as well as a Master's of Law and a Doctorate of the Science of Law, both from Yale Law School. Professor Lubin's list of appointments and positions is impressive, but he started his path and interest in intelligence not as an academic, but rather as an analyst in the Israel Defense Forces Intelligence Branch from 2005 to 2009. His over 10 years of research into law and ethics that govern espionage culminates in his forthcoming book, The International Law of Intelligence, The World of Spycraft, and The Law of Nations, published by Oxford University Press. I knew of Professor Lubin before I even met him, stumbling across reading and citing to his scholarship on privacy rights in modern warfare. I then had the honor of meeting him at American University's Tech Law and Security's annual cyber symposium this past fall. At this symposium, we talked about how both he and I teach intelligence law at our respective institutions, and what really caught my attention were his thoughts on international law's role in governing espionage. This is because, generally speaking, it is domestic law that governs how states conduct their foreign intelligence activities, and also how they prosecute those who spy on them, not international law. And it's for this reason I asked Professor Lubin to chat with me today about his thoughts and his extensive research, all reflected in this forthcoming book, on why that perhaps needs to change, and how in practice it could change, or maybe is already changing. Professor Lubin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for that kind introduction and for having me on your podcast.
So I'd like to start at the beginning. As I mentioned in my intro, not only have you been researching and studying this topic for many years, including through your doctoral dissertation, but you operated in the world of intelligence as an analyst for the IDF. So you have practical and firsthand experience of what it means to engage in intelligence gathering on the operational side of things. But what's so interesting is that after your service with the IDF, you then served as a Robert L. Bernstein Human Rights Fellow with Privacy International, which is a London-based civil society organization that advocates for the rights of privacy and, in fact, litigates against intelligence agencies. So you've sort of seen both sides of the coin, and so safe to say you understand these competing interests of national security and protecting civil liberties, which is a theme that I also teach here in the JAG School when we talk about the domestic frameworks here in the United States. So my first question is, how has your experience as an intel analyst and operator, combined with your experience as a defender against government intrusion into privacy, shaped your outlook and your research in this area?
I think that's a really helpful question to begin with. So I'm 39 today, but when I turned 18, I joined the Israeli intelligence community, as you said. One of the first thing I went through is an intelligence training course where I was being trained about the work. And I don't recall a single conversation we had during my training about ethics, about what it means to spy on a person, rules of engagement, let alone about the law, the rights to privacy or data protection, which was very different than my colleagues' experiences in combat units. They were being trained both about the law, about the Geneva Conventions, and about the ethics, what it means to use a firearm, rules of engagement, and what it means to kill a person. And that troubled me throughout my service, in particular because my service included some vexing ethical dilemmas. I'll just share one example. Early on in my position, I was required to investigate the sexual orientation of a particular target. Now, I myself was a gay man, very much in the closet and coming to terms with my own sexuality. I, in retrospect, think a lot about that experience, both about the permissibility or lack thereof of that form of intelligence gathering, but also about the lack of ethical training and therapeutic training that I was giving at the time, which is what led me to doing this research. For the next 10 years, I investigated the international law of intelligence, as you said, mostly at Yale Law School as a master's and doctoral student and then as a professor. But I also spent that stint at Privacy International. Privacy International is an NGO that protects the right to privacy against unfeathered surveillance. And when I was working for them, they often described me as the mole within them, the former intelligence operator now working against intelligence agencies. But really what it provided me is a balanced position from which to see the world. I today take a very pragmatic viewpoint that recognizes both the national security and the civil liberties issues at the forefront of intelligence gathering activities. And I say this predominantly because scholarship and pedagogy, teaching in law schools, often lacks intelligence courses, let alone ones that focus on the international dimensions of the practice. So it's a really unique position from which to operate.
And so with that, I'd like to dive into your scholarship specifically. And you write and you talk about how espionage is one of the oldest professions in the world. Nations have spied on each other, both in peace and wartime, for centuries. And so you think it's a logical thought to think that there would be a specific body of law that would regulate the conduct of nations internationally. You know, after all, we have the law of armed conflict, law that governs violence, something that would seem insane to somebody maybe 200-300 years ago, and yet we have it, and it's pretty robust and governs how we execute violence against one another. And yet nothing parallel, at least yet, has emerged to govern espionage. So my question is, would you mind explaining why you think that is and how states and academics assess international law to currently govern espionage?
Yeah, no, great question. So historically speaking, we used to operate in absolutist terms in the way we've thought about the permissibility or lack thereof of espionage. For centuries, philosophical and legal thought around the practice has rooted in two major camps. On the one side was people like Sun Tzu and Hobbes and Grotius, who believed that spying was always illegal. Hobbes, in fact, says that spying is like rays of sun unto the human spirit. He compared the nation state into a spider, and its spies, this are the spider web, feeding the mother spider with information. In the spirit of Grotius, he said that to spy is a necessity of world affairs because of surprise attacks that this nation state needs to prevent and protect its people from. And so a leader who chooses not to spy is like a dereliction of duty. You have a duty to engage in intelligence, meaning that spying is always legal, no matter what is the means employed or the justifications for the gathering. In fact, in Sun Tzu's word, spy, spy, and spy again. But on the other side stands someone like Kant. Now, Kant believed in a perpetual peace, and the only way to achieve such perpetual peace is through the bonds of trust and collaborations between the nation. And you know what is the number one assault on that collaboration and trust? It is espionage, because states might forget club strokes, but they will never forget the pinches of the needle, the attacks on their ego that comes from intelligence gathering, which is why Kant called it, quote, a diabolical act to spy. Spying is always illegal, no matter what is the justification for it or which means are employed. But I think contemporary scholarship kind of evolved from both those absolutist terms to introduce an even third absolutist camp, that spying is extra legal. It exists outside the bounds of law. John F. Sheen Ratzen, former CIA, wrote an article about this in 2007. John Yoo, another example of someone who has opined that spying is an extra legal construct. It's neither legal nor illegal. And in fact, I would say that that is the way Cold War era thinking and development kind of emerged. We never spoke about spying at the UN. Spying was a taboo word, the E word or the I word. If you think about the SALT agreements between the United States and the Soviet Union in the 1970s, they used this washed-up term, national technical means of verification. But what they really mean is espionage. And so in this context, there was no venue nor discourse to generate meaningful international regulation. And you might think about this like the three monkeys' attitude to intelligence. We see no evil, do no evil, think no evil. We're just kind of blind to this thing that is definitely there in the background, but for which international law is somewhat silent. And I think that for some international lawyers, this remains the kind of starting point for thinking about espionage.
In your book, you also reason that this discourse has evolved in recent decades. Like, much of the law has started to evolve when it comes to current technologies, particularly in the wake of cyber espionage and SIGINT capabilities that are becoming more widespread and well-documented. You argue there's a shift in this discourse, and now international lawyers perhaps are looking to general international law to regulate intelligence. So can you sort of expand on that for us?
Absolutely. So the 1990s saw the end of the Cold War and the rise of a rule-based legal order led by predominantly the United States as a single entity. It also saw the rise of human rights into preeminence, the joining of many states into both major international human rights treaties, the ICCPR and the ICESCR. But we also saw in the 2000 and 2010 growing movement to regulate cyberspace at the UN level, some of it in reaction to the Snowden revelations of the early 2010s, which revealed the scope of mass surveillance capabilities being leveraged by the Five Eyes intelligence community, which has resulted in UN General Assembly resolutions, repeated resolutions, and special rapporteurs being created on the right to privacy at the UN Human Rights Council, all generating a new kind of discourse, a discourse in which we might start to use international law to think about the way intelligence is regulated. In fact, because cyber activity, which is being sought to regulate, is constantly beginning with unauthorized access, beginning with intelligence gathering, nation states who wanted to opine on the permissibility of cyber activity started their analysis with international law's applicability, and in so doing reflected on whether or not international law could regulate some of these unauthorized access. But what has been said by scholars in the last 20 years is still, in my view, under persuasive. So you look at the Tallinn Manual on the law applicable, international law applicable to cyber operations. And what they say is that espionage is, quote, not per se regulated by international law. Other scholars, Craig Forsese from Canada, Russell Buchan from the UK, Kevin John Heller and Peters, have all position themselves in suggesting similarly that only general principles of international law could regulate spying. So if intelligence is not per se regulated, it's not that we look at intelligence as a conduct and its function and its activity to regulate spying. Rather, we ask, how do general prohibitions that apply without regard to intelligence might constrain particular intelligence activity? So spying from an embassy or on an embassy are both illegal because they violate particular rules of the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. Spying from a submerged submarine in the territorial waters of a state violates particular provisions of the UN Convention of the Law of the Sea. So it too is illegal. And most importantly, sending a physical spy into your territory would violate the principle of sovereignty. So that too is definitively illegal. Notice that each of these examples and others these authors write about are not ones in which the intelligence operation is assessed as such. We're not interested in why you spied, what was motivating your spying, and how you engage in that spying activity. We're only interested in this kind of general method of collection and how that method of collection correlated or did not correlate with particular forms of spying. And I'll just say that this approach is wrong for multiple reasons. First, it fails to acknowledge the important functions that state-sponsored intelligence gatherings plays in sustaining our legal order, something we'll get back to in a moment. But second, it ignores the availability of customary rules that I would contend have already emerged, or at the very least are emerging, in the way states conduct these intelligence activities. And lastly, it offers an ineffective framework for regulating espionage, since rules like sovereignty are just too blunt of a tool to deal with the specific and challenging nuances of intelligence as a practice.
So you talk about how we've shifted to perhaps this idea that only general principles of international law govern espionage. But your book really is about rejecting this notion, sort of as you've just alluded to in the end of the answer of that last question. And in your book, you propose an alternative. You propose what you call the International Law of Intelligence, or ILI, which is this new body of law, a lex specialis, if you will, a self-contained regime of particular rules that cover the entire spectrum of the intelligence cycle, getting to the issue that you just talked about, which is the question of why. What is the reason we're doing this, and answering the mail perhaps more specifically on that. And so in mirroring LOAC, you break down ILI temporally to the three phases of an operation: use add, use in, and use post rules. So what is this framework? What is this framework that you're proposing, and how does it function?
Absolutely. So as you heard so far, the existing discourse, to the extent it is suggested international law applies to intelligence gathering activities, only does so through blunt tools. Blunt tools that by design are incapable of understanding intelligence core functions, understanding what intelligence is meant to achieve, and addressing questions around what is permissible, impermissible ways of conducting intelligence activities that take into account the ethical standards that are evolving from the ground up through the history and practice, the rich, nuanced cultural history of intelligence activities over the last thousands of years. And so an alternative approach suggests, no, maybe we need to look at how intelligence agencies operate. What do they do? What do they say? And how that conduct constrains their behavior. And that too should shape the way the law evolves. So what I propose, this idea, the ILI, the International Law of Intelligence, is a lex specialis self-contained regime that is derived from this history and culture. And in fact, I'm not the one who has written about it, suggested it first. I'm actually building on the shoulders of giants. These are scholars who have written about just intelligence theory. They have taken just war theory, that theory we all know and study at length, and they've suggested that we can adopt that model for thinking about intelligence activities too. That is, the regulation of intelligence at three distinct temporal phases: before, during, and after an operation. So like the use ad bellum, use in bellum, use post bellum framework, they suggest that we can think of use ad explorationem, the law justifying intelligence gathering activities, the law for launching an intelligence operation, use in explorazione, the law governing the targeting, the law governing the means and the targets employed in the conduct of particular spying operations, and use post explorationem, rules governing state responsibility and individual accountability after the operations cease, as well as remedies available in cases of abuse. This three-part model suggests that we can look at the entire intelligence cycle from start to finish and ask the question whether or not a violation of these tailored, particularized rules have happened in each of these scenarios.
I want to dig a little bit deeper into this function that ILI hopes to answer, but the function is even broader than the operations themselves. In your scholarship, you claim intelligence plays an important function also in international order. In fact, you assert in your writings that states have an obligation to spy in peacetime. It's not just a mere liberty to do so. And that obligation is to ensure their national security, as well as further communal goals like international security and stability. So it goes beyond the state themselves. So let's take each of these points in turn, if you don't mind. So first, Professor, what is the function that intelligence plays in the broader legal order? And two, if states have an obligation to spy, does that equate to a right to do so? And if so, is that right absolute?
Great question. So we're looking now deeper into the jus ad explorationem, the law governing the justifications for spying, which are rooted in the functions that espionage plays in the international legal order. And this is already where I propose some provocative claims, but I think ones that are quite persuasive. Under international law, states today have a set of obligations that no one disputes. States have an obligation to protect the rights to life of their people under international human rights law. States also have obligations to comply with the principles of distinction and proportionality under international humanitarian law. States also have obligations to protect the right to self-determination, both of their own people through self-defense and self-preservation against aggressors, and the rights of self-determination of other people through the doctrine of humanitarian intervention. Now, in all of these scenarios, you need to gather intelligence as a prerequisite for manifesting these obligations effectively. Now, some of these duties may be discharged by way of uncontroversial means of intelligence gathering. So you might use the global commons like outer space, or you might use open source intelligence gathering in order to prevent surprise attacks on your people. But as is often the case, it might not be sufficient to rely on open source intelligence or images from outer space in order to protect your people from these sorts of surprise attacks. You might need to rely on territorially intrusive means in order to conduct your operations. In fact, some of the cheapest ways of conducting intelligence gathering are from embassies. And indeed, that's one notorious way by which states engage in interstate intelligence gathering activities. The diplomat was the lawful spy, as he was introduced into literature. And so to deny all that activity, to make it illegal, seems to be in contradiction with what we see in practice and does not comply with the very functions that intelligence is supposed to serve in our international rules. And so international law really engages in a trade-off. Intelligence to the pinnacle elite entails more likelihood for rational decision-making and less likelihood for deterioration to violence out of security dilemmas. And so we want our elites to have all these accurate, effective information in real time to ensure greater international peace and security, to avoid informational asymmetries, to avoid irrational fears. But at the same time, the international community also realizes that intelligence can be abused. It can be used in ways that could deteriorate into violence, because the more I spy on you, the more you wonder if there is something to fear, the more you might engage in security dilemmas that lead to violence. And so the trade-off there is that we tolerate some, but not all, intelligence gathering activities. And the international community has organically designed particular rules for spy and spied on how to resolve those disputes, which gets me to the final question you ask me. So fine, even if there is some right to spy for nation states, does international law recognize it as an absolute right? And what has been designed organically in the relationship between state is not an absolute right, not a Hoffeldian right, to throw in some Hoffeldian philosophy, but rather a liberty to spy. That liberty is matched with a liberty to prevent spying on you. It's a liberty-liberty relationship, meaning that I can spy on you and you can criminalize spying. And both of this are not generating something contradictory within the law. Rather, they are all in sync with a legal order that says all states should be allowed to spy, but all states should also try to do their best to prevent spying on them because they have a right to protect their privacy and their secrets. And so in that frame, states gather intelligence, but that does not mean that the receiving end, the surveilled states, have a duty to allow that surveillance to take hold. They do what they can to prevent that spying. And in that environment, particular rules of enforcement would emerge. One notorious one I'll end with is the doctrine of persona non grata, right? When Angela Merkel discovers that the United States spied on her, the first thing she does is that she sends out the CIA attaché from the embassy in Berlin saying, you're now a persona non grata. That is set out within the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations as the only possible response to that kind of development. It's a remedy built within the system to address the relationship between spy and spied.
So you say there's sort of this customary practice that's what it sounds like, and I agree with you, sort of already built in to the intelligence community, that there is some in espionage activities that's tolerated, but not all. And so I'd love to elaborate a little bit on that piece, that not all piece. We talked about examples that are accepted, but what are some examples that states may abuse their liberty to spy or act in a manner that the international community may consider violative of this legal order and beyond that toleration threshold?
Yes. So let me give you two examples of abuses within jus ad explorationem and one example of an abuse within jus in exploratione. So starting with jus ad explorationem, how can a state abuse that? I would suggest to you that there are customary norms, and to a lesser extent, if you're not persuaded that custom has evolved in this space, some scholars think that custom cannot evolve from secret practice, then I have a fallback argument in my book that general principles of international law might nonetheless fill the gaps, the voids in this context. And so one particular general principle is the principle of abuse of rights. A state cannot use its right not for the function for which it was intended. So jus ad explorationem very much deals with abuses of rights, using the function of national security intelligence for purposes other than international security or national security. Let me give you two examples of that. The first comes from the Czech Republic. The former prime minister of the Czech Republic had an affair with this chief of staff, and she was very interested in getting him to divorce his wife. And so she put two intelligence officers to follow her as she was traveling abroad in the hope that that would reveal some nefarious information about her doings that she could use to persuade the prime minister to divorce her. When this was discovered, she was tried in court. And what the judge says in that domestic court case is that the chief of staff, quote, abused the right to spy. She used the national security spying apparatus not for the purpose for which it was intended. She used it to advance personal gains, personal interests, not the national interest. That is one example of an abuse of the jus ad explorationem. Here's another. That's a very known story from Australia and East Timor. It's known because it made its way to two different international cases, both at a permanent court of arbitration and at the International Court of Justice. In that case, Australia placed recording devices into the cabinet offices of the newly built cabinet offices of the East Timorese government. In 2006, when the East Timorese discovered gas in the East Timorese Sea, they used those recording devices in order to spy on the negotiations leading up to an agreement in which Australia would assist in extracting gas from the East Timorese Sea. So every day they would leave the room, they would listen in to what the East Timorese was saying, and they would better their negotiating position for the next day, spying during treaty negotiations. That indeed led to an agreement that was very favorable to Australia's interest. In 2011, Agent K comes out of the Australian intelligence community and he says, enough is enough. I have to come clean. East Timor, we spied on you during treaty negotiations. The East Timorese get enraged. Friends don't spy on friends. And they sue. They sue first at a permanent court of arbitration in The Hague under the agreement that they signed around the extraction of the gas, saying that that violated good faith obligations during negotiations. But then when Australia got a court order for national security reasons to seize the legal materials that the lawyer they represented them in The Hague was developing, the East Timorese got enraged again, and they sue a second time, this time at the International Court of Justice. The ICJ, in a provisional measure decision, said that that act, the collection of the information of the lawyer, might violate some rule of international law around privilege between states and their attorneys. But the big picture of that incident is a demonstration of the kind of abusive spying that Australia engaged in. Australia was not spying to advance its national security interests. East Timor did not pose any national security threats to Australia, nor was it there to advance international peace and stability. Rather, it employed its spying functions to advance its own post-colonial relationships, to ensure that it is able to collect gas, extract resources against a developing country that needed those resources. So that's a second example. A third final example comes from jus in explorationem. This is about the choice of means and targets in the conduct of spying. So think about the CIA operation in the lead up to finding Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. There, the CIA employed an unofficial cover where they placed two of its officials within a vaccination program of the United Nations in Pakistan to vaccinate children for the polio. The thought was, that was never really fully fleshed out, is that in the process of collecting DNA samples and blood samples, they would somehow find some key information that could lead them to Osama bin Laden. Now, not only did that not manifest, and arguably would have never had chances of manifesting, but more fundamentally, when it was discovered, 60% of families in Pakistan refused to vaccinate their children for the polio, claiming it was a Western hoax. Now, in each of these three examples, we see abuses of the function. In this last one, we're using, it might be lawful to spy on Pakistan to find Osama bin Laden as a matter of jus ad explorationem to advance national security interests and even international stability through capturing Osama bin Laden. But it violates the jus in explorationem because it violates principles of proportionality, the adverse effects, let alone basic standards of efficacy, the likelihood of success of the operation. The reason I chose these three cases to highlight to you is because in all three of them, the result was enforcement. So in the Czech Republic, the chief of staff gets arrested for abusing the right to spy. In Australia, East Timor, Australia had to break away from its old agreement and was compelled through these court processes, which it wanted to see end, sign a new agreement with East Timor, reinstating some of its rights over the gas. And in the CIA context in Pakistan, a number of leading deans of medical schools across the United States wrote a letter both to the CIA chief and to then President Obama, demanding that they will announce that never again will they engage in unofficial covers involving UN medical programs, which the Obama administration had to publicly denounce the following year. And so what all of these demonstrate is that this thing, espionage, could result in use post-explorationem, that is, in actual post-program, post-operation enforcement, individually, collectively, acknowledgments of responsibility, acknowledgments of mistakes of the kind that we expect to see in other domains of state responsibility.
Thank you for those examples. I think they're really helpful and sort of demonstrating what you're proposing in your book. My final question, Professor Lubin, is how do you envision ILI being developed? It's really a rubber meets the road question. In today's very volatile geopolitical environment, are we expecting states to sign on to a new Geneva Convention specifically for intelligence law? How do you envision it being implemented formally, informally? I'm just curious your thoughts on just how this could potentially be implemented.
I wish we'd come to the day of an intelligence. In fact, by the way, in 1880, there was proposals for an international treaty that outlaws intelligence. It went nowhere.
I can imagine.
Yeah. And so, no, I am very, I'm not googly-eyed. I'm very mindful of the limitations, especially at the current political climate we're in. But that's what's so interesting, I think, about the way I propose we envision the ILI, which is very much rooted in the way intelligence develops and progresses in real time. Some areas of international law of intelligence will see structured codification efforts. What we saw just recently at the UN level on cyberspace, the UN Cybercrime Convention, is an example of a multilateral codification effort that resulted in a treaty. We might see similar efforts now around the use of military artificial intelligence. So I would contend that a lot of it around the cyber SIGINT context might manifest in more codified efforts. We've also seen codification efforts in other domains. You might think about torture, and the torture convention is one area of intelligence gathering that is highly regulated. But there are certainly other domains that will never see codification efforts through structured formal treaties. In those spaces, I would contend that we will see something that is more akin to what the New Haven School of International Law likes to talk about as organic development of the operational code and where it meets the myth system of treaties and general principles. That is, we will see states behave. We will see intelligence agencies develop standards and rules of conduct. And if we study those and examine them for what they are, they might help shape the way we think about the normative expectations of the parties. And some of that might manifest in general customary rules. Others might manifest actually in particular custom. Particular custom is a concept that the International Law Commission introduced to suggest that certain countries, even not ones of a geographical location, a single geographical location, but one who share some kind of an arrangement or an understanding, might develop particular customs among them. So intelligence collaboration organizations or arrangements might generate particular customs for the members of those arrangements, which could help at least elucidate the rules between the like-minded states, which could be a first step towards something more robust. So the road for intelligence regulation in international law is long and hard. It's not for the faint-hearted, but it's nonetheless exciting and important for our time.
I think that's a great way to start the wrap-up of today's episode. This has been such a fascinating and thought-provoking discussion. Professor Lubin, thank you for making the time, traveling to TJAGLEX to discuss this with me. And I really, truly look forward to the release of your book. Any final thoughts before we end today's episode?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for inviting me to speak about these issues today. I will leave you with one final thought, which is that intelligence is an area of importance for study that is often gets neglected in pedagogy, in education. And I think that produces a self-fulfilling prophecy in the sense that when our next generation of intelligence officers and our next generation of leaders are not taught that intelligence is something they need to understand when thinking about international rules, they will then proceed to think that international rules are just immaterial in this context. And what is troubling to me is that most syllabi in international law today, most casebooks in international law today, ignore intelligence as an area of state practice for study, despite the fact that it produces such an interesting, innovative edge case for thinking about international law. So I've had the privilege of teaching espionage and international law as a graduate course and an undergraduate course at Yale and at Columbia and at my home institution right now at Indiana University. I have endless sea of syllabi. And so to any audience member who is listening to us, if you're interested in this topic, and if you've discovered it, you're interested in this topic through this podcast today, please reach out to me. I'll be happy to share my syllabi with you, come guest lecture in your classes, whatever it takes so that we can increase the pedagogical conversation around these issues.
And I myself have taken you up on that as you teach the Intel elective for the GDP, the graduate degree program, this afternoon. So thank you again for your time. It's been so fascinating, Professor Lubin, and I really truly look forward to your book. Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode of NSL Unscripted was brought to you by the National Security Law Department at the U.S. Army's Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. The views presented are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views of the Department of Defense, its components, the Department of the Army, or the Judge Advocate General's Legal Center and School. Our department also publishes the Operational Law Handbook available online. We hope you enjoyed this episode and look forward to future episodes for NSL practitioners.